It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The Smithsonian Institute has been called America's attic. It is home to many iconic objects, from industry to culture, that have shaped our nation. In his book, History of America in 101 Objects, our guest, Smithsonian curator Dr. Richard Curran, chronicles these national treasures, from Abe Lincoln's stovepipe hat to Judy Garland's ruby red shoes. The Senator John Hines History Center, an affiliate of the Smithsonian Institution, will host Richard Curran as part of a special book event tomorrow at 11 a.m. And he joins us now in Studio A. Richard Curran, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. It's great to be here.
Sounds like a really fun book to put together, by the way. If you have any questions about any of the items in the book, how it was put together, how these items are chosen, not just to be included in the book, but in the museum or in the institute, you can call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. What are some of the items you put in your book? I mentioned Abe Lincoln's hat, which would be really fun to try on, and Judy Garland's ruby red shoes, which for some might also be fun to try on.
Right. I don't think they'd fit you, Paul.
That's not a good visual. But anyway, what are some of the items that you put in your book?
Well, everything from the Star Spangled Banner, you know, which was the inspiration for our national anthem.
And we're talking about the actual big flag that flew over Fort McHenry during the War of 1812.
That's right. You know, you're talking about the 200th anniversary of that, to the space shuttle discovery that recently came to the Smithsonian. And, you know, people are familiar with the Smithsonian museums and the artifacts, but we also have the National Zoo. So one of those objects is the pandas, you know, that originally we got from China and now that we have at the zoo. So it's really the range of materials that document American history. Now, Kermit the Frog is in there with Miss Piggy, but so are serious items like the Salk vaccine, which was invented right here in Pittsburgh, Jonas Salk in the 1950s. The trial started here in the Pittsburgh area. And, you know, think back to those times in the 1950s when polio was public enemy number one.
Well, it was a very frightening, the prospect of it, and parents and children were rightfully very afraid of contracting this. And that research, of course, went on right here at Pitt. So there are a lot of things, and let's talk about the things that are Pittsburgh and Western PA related that are a part of your 101 objects. Now, you mentioned the Salk vaccine, but what you have is you have a syringe, right?
We have the syringe and the vials of the original vaccine, you know, because it was three different strands of the virus. So we have a lot of documentation from that time, including the dimes, you know, that we used in the March of Dimes. Mm. Many of the documents. But from Western Pennsylvania, you know, we have a Conestoga wagon. I mean, this was on the trail of the, you know, the wagon until the railroads came to Pittsburgh in the 1850s. And the Hines History Center also has a Conestoga wagon. But they were part of our transportation system at that time. We have George Washington's sword that he used to review the troops out here at Bedford after the Whiskey Rebellion. It's a beautiful carved sword that the Washington family really entrusted and donated to the nation. We have, you know, in the Smithsonian and in this collection, Andy Warhol's Marilyn Monroe, the lips, and you know his creations.
Now, in the context of these other items that you mentioned, how does something like Warhol's painting of Marilyn Monroe fit in with the history of America?
Well, if you think about it, you know, here was a time, you know, he was inspired after Marilyn Monroe's death to do that poster. And Warhol was doing commentary on our contemporary American life. And he was very interested in the relationship between art and commerce. And here was Marilyn Monroe, you know, who defined at that point in the 1950s, you know, sexual glamour, female sexuality, and its exploitation. I mean, it's tragic exploitation. So, you know, Warhol was a great commenter on American contemporary life. So, you know, in the book, I also deal with McDonald's and television and Mickey Mouse and other items of our popular culture. And so looking at Warhol, you get a good sense of how we thought about what we were doing, or at least some people thought about what they were doing.
Sure. We're talking with Smithsonian curator Dr. Richard Curran. His book is History of America in 101 Objects, choosing from the items on display at the Smithsonian, 101 objects, which really doesn't seem like very many to put in the book and talk about the history of America. If you have a comment or a question, 412-246-2002 is the number to call, 412-246-2002. And, you know, I'm curious about how you decide what to put in and what and more importantly, what to leave out. And when I think about some of the more obscure items in the Smithsonian, you have maybe not so obscure, but ones that people wouldn't necessarily expect to find there. I believe the swamp from MASH, where you know Hawkeye and Trapper lived, is in there. And then you have the Fonz's leather jacket, and there's also the car that Mario Andretti used to win the Indy 500. So are any of those in your book? And if so, how do you decide what you're going to leave out?
Well, it's interesting. Not easy. You know, look, the Smithsonian has 137 million things.
Right.
So, you know, you want to see the things in the Smithsonian. Even when you go to the museums, you only get to glimpse about 1% of them.
It takes about a week, really, you'd think, to get through all of it.
Absolutely, which is why we lend objects, for example, to the Heinz History Center and other museums around the country. So at the Heinz Center, you could see the prototype of the Jeep. Because we don't have it on display at the Smithsonian. You can see it here. So you only see about 1 million things or 1.5 million things at the Smithsonian. Now, when I did this book, I got to my fellow curators around the Smithsonian. I said, well, what would you pick if you had to pick 101?
So you had discussions about
this. We had discussions. Now, just imagine what the people at the National Postal Museum said. Like, every one of those 101 should be a stamp.
Right.
And portraits and so on. So I got from the curators. I also looked. We get 30 million people visit the Smithsonian every year. And so you look literally at where the carpet is worn. What do the American people want to see? And you get a sense of that. And then I just pick some objects that have never been on display because I thought they helped tell the story of the Smithsonian. So one of them, for example, in the book is the Bakelizer. This was the
what?
The Bakelizer. This was the birthplace of the polyester kingdom, the first machine that made plastic.
It was called the Bakelizer?
The Bakelizer. After this guy Bakeland, a Belgian immigrant to this country, never been on display. But what a story. We live in the age of plastic. So, I tell that story.
Well, it's like that line in The Graduate, you know, one word, plastics.
Plastics. That's exactly it. But then, you know, there's things we have on display or on display very rarely. You know, for example, we have the We Can Do It poster, that iconic poster. World War II of women.
Rosie the Riveter?
Well, it was later called Rosie the Riveter. Now, that came out of Westinghouse here in Pittsburgh.
Okay.
And it was designed for the war effort when it was first created by this guy, design artist Miller. It wasn't Rosie the Riveter. It later got called Rosie the Riveter after the famous song came out and a Norman Rockwell painting came out. And then, with the rise of the women's movement, it really became Rosie the Riveter and really iconographic. So I kind of tell not only the story of these things in history, but how they got to be national treasures. And then, you know, how they became subject of either controversy or reinterpretation.
What are some controversial ones? What are some of the items around which controversy has arisen?
Sure. Well, you know, think of, you know, for example, the Enola Gay, the bomber that dropped the atom bomb on Hiroshima, became the subject of controversy when we were going to display it in 1995 when the anniversary of a 50th anniversary of the end of World War II. And we have there's a few things. One of the airplanes that actually has a connection to this area was the Wright Flyer. And there was a guy, Langley, Sam Langley, who was a prominent astrophysicist, worked here in Allegheny.
We're talking about Wilbur and Orville Wright.
Wilbur and Orville Wright. They flew in 1903. Langley, who came from this area, was a competitor of theirs. They actually asked him for his notes. He was the most distinguished astrophysicist of the country. He was head of the Smithsonian. He made a plane, the Aerodrome. It went into the drink in the tidal basin in Washington. It did not fly. But when we put up an exhibit back in the early 1900s about flight, there was a sign on his plane, his resurrected Aerodrome, said, the first plane capable of flight.
And this was, and they did this in, was it 1898?
This was like, he did it like 1898. This was put up on an exhibit in 1914. Well, the Wright brothers didn't want to have their plane. They said, we were first in flight. How can you have the sign on this, you know, this guy's airplane? And so the Wright brothers refused to give their plane to the Smithsonian until after World War II. Charles Lindbergh intervened in terms of those discussions. Other people did. Finally, the Smithsonian said, okay, we'll change the sign.
Wow.
and recognize the Wright brothers. So even something you
and
think
and
is
was
simple,
that the right thing to do? I mean, was that accurate?
It was totally – the Wright brothers were accurate. I think it was a kind of homage by the other secretary who succeeded Langley. He wanted to respect him and do well by him, but it was overstated. And so, you know, I can get into these kind of controversies over objects in our collection because I think they help tell the story. You know, American history is not natural. Our heritage is not made. It's often contentious. What's very important to some people and so valuable may be devalued by others.
We're talking with Dr. Richard Curran. He is one of the curators or the Smithsonian curator, and he'll be speaking tomorrow at the Heinz History Center, which is an affiliate of the Smithsonian Institution, and it'll be a special book event regarding his book, History of America in 101 Objects. Again, that's tomorrow morning at 11 at the Heinz History Center. He's here with us now to take your questions, and we have Frank in Monroeville joining the conversation. Frank, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hello, how are you doing?
Well, thank you.
You received my questions concerning the Enola Gay.
Did you also email questions? Well, go
no.
ahead and ask them. Why don't you just, as long as we have you on the phone, Frank?
Yes, I have two questions. Number one, or comment, I recently went to see the Enola Gay and found that it was not in the Air and Space Museum, but at another location. Is there a reason for this?
Okay, let's find out.
Okay, well, Frank, the Enola Gay is in the Smithsonian. It's in the Udvar-Hazy Center, which is part of the Smithsonian. It's our Air and Space Museum over at Dulles Airport. Frankly,
yes.
It wouldn't fit on the mall. The same thing. That's why you saw the Discovery there, the space shuttle
yes.
Discovery in the Hazy Center, because we have planes that were actually too big to get
yeah,
into
it's
the
Yeah, it's a little bit bigger than the Spirit of St. Louis, for example.
Yes.
Okay.
And my second question was, I was once told by my allergist, who was part of the research team under Dr. Jonas Salk, he maintained that Dr. Salk did not actually do the discovery of the Salk vaccine, but he was the administrator of a program. Someone else, and he told me the name of the person and told me that he actually committed suicide. Someone else made the actual discovery. And I wondered if anyone had really turned up. I'm trying to validate that piece of information, and I wondered if anyone else had really went into that question in depth.
I have never seen anything to indicate that anyone other than Jonas Salk was, in fact, the man who did the research and discovered the polio vaccine. But what do you know about it, Dr. Curran?
Yeah, well, look, when you're doing that kind of scientific research, remember, there was being research done on immunology that Salk was doing back when he was in New York City, that he had a team of researchers working on it. Whenever you're doing something like that, you have a lot of people contributing to the project. That's what big science is about. And remember, there were 1.8 million people involved in even the testing of the vaccine. So, you know, they're big projects. People contribute different things. But I don't think there's any really historical question that Salk was the leader of the project. And, you know, it bears his name. And he did the heavy lifting on this one.
Thank you, Frank, for the phone call. And also just to add one last thought about Jonas Salk is that he is someone who could have benefited greatly commercially and refused to allow that happen. Is that correct?
That's correct. And he also, remember, at that time, you know, testing standards were different and protocols were different than they are today. But he actually tested the vaccine on himself, his family, other people in his lab. So, you know, he was deeply committed to, you know, solving what was a terrible crisis and public health problem in the country.
Before we wrap up, I wanted to talk about how people react when they see some of the items that you have included in your book when they go to the Smithsonian. And I was very interested in how you characterize and observe the way people react when they come across the Star-Spangled Banner, again, the flag that flew over Fort McHenry during the War of 1812 that inspired our national anthem written by Francis Scott Key. What have you observed with regard to the way people approach the flag and wanting to touch it and that kind of thing.
It's really amazing because, you know, look, hey, you know, Pittsburgh is a great sports town. So before great events and basketball, Steelers games, Pirates games, you know, people singing the national anthem.
Sure.
And you sing it and it's kind of ritualistic. Flag goes up. But when you see that flag that was really inspired that song at the Smithsonian, it's huge. You know, it was originally, 40 feet by 30 feet. The hair on the back of your neck stands up. You realize you're looking at and you're close to, you can almost touch and reach out to history. You realize the fragility of our country at that time. You realize what our country made. And I've taken many leaders through there and many of visitors through there, and you really feel connected to our sense of a country. It's quite amazing. That happens with a lot of objects. When we did an exhibit on 9/11 and had the objects out, we didn't have a lot of signage. We just had things on tables with black tablecloths. And when you saw the crumpled up tray from Flight 93 that went into Shanksville, and you look at that and you're standing up close, you really feel close to that event. And I think it just brings home emotionally your connection to a larger country, to events in history that affect us.
Dr. Richard Curran is a Smithsonian curator and author of the book History of America in 101 Objects. Dr. Curran, it's been a pleasure visiting with you. And again, a reminder that he will be speaking tomorrow at the Heinz History Center at 11 a.m. Again, Dr. Curran, thanks for being with us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. Good to be here.
Coming up, we'll preview this weekend's Pittsburgh Indie Comics Expo. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.